H.P. Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. Read and performed by William E. Hart. Chapter 3. A Search and an Evocation. 4. It was toward May when Dr. Willett, at the request of the senior ward, and fortified with all the Kerwin data which the family had gleaned from Charles in his non-secretive days, talked with the young man. The interview was of little value or conclusiveness, for Willett felt at every moment that Charles was thoroughly master of himself and in touch with matters of real importance, but it at least forced the secretive youth to offer some rational explanation of his recent demeanor. Of a pallid, impassive type not easily showing embarrassment, Ward seemed quite ready to discuss his pursuits, though not to reveal their object. He stated that the papers of his ancestor had contained some remarkable secrets of early scientific knowledge, for the most part in cipher, of an apparent scope comparable only to the discoveries of Friar Bacon and perhaps surpassing even those. They were, however, meaningless except when correlated with a body of learning now wholly obsolete, so that their immediate presentation to a world equipped only with modern science would rob them of all impressiveness and dramatic significance. To take their vivid place in the history of human thought, they must first be correlated by one familiar with the background out of which they evolved, and to this task of correlation Ward was now devoting himself. He was seeking to acquire as fast as possible those neglected arts of old which a true interpreter of the Kerwin data must possess, and hoped in time to make a full announcement and presentation of the utmost interest of mankind into the world of thought. Not even Einstein, he declared, could more profoundly revolutionize the current conception of things. As to his graveyard search, whose object he freely admitted, but the details of whose progress he did not relate, he said he had reason to think that Joseph Kerwin's mutilated headstone bore certain mystic symbols, carved from directions in his will and ignorantly spared by those who had effaced the name, which were absolutely essential to the final solution of his cryptic system. Kerwin, he believed, had wished to guard his secret with care, and had consequently distributed the data in an exceedingly curious fashion. When Dr. Willett asked to see the mystic documents, Ward displayed much reluctance and tried to put him off with such things as photostatic copies of the Hutchison cipher and Oren formulae and diagrams, but finally showed him the exteriors of some of the real Kerwin finds, the
journal and notes,
the cipher, title in cipher also, and the formula-filled message,
"To him who shall come after,"
and let him glance inside such as were in obscure characters. He also opened the diary at a page carefully selected for its innocuousness and gave Willett a glimpse of Kerwin's connected handwriting in English. The doctor noted very closely the crabbed and complicated letters, and the general aura of the 17th century which clung round both penmanship and style despite the writer's survival into the 18th century, and became quickly certain that the document was genuine. The text itself was relatively trivial, and Willett recalled only a fragment.
"Wednesday 16, October 1754. My sloop, the Wakeful, this day put in from London with 20 new men picked up in the Indies, Spaniards from Martinico and 2 Dutchmen from Suriname. The Dutchmen are like to desert from having heard somewhat ill of these ventures, but I will see to the inducing of them to stay. For Mr. Knight Dexter of the Boy and Book, 120 pieces camblets, 100 pieces assorted cambeltines, 20 pieces blue duffels, 100 pieces shalloons, 50 pieces calamancos, 300 pieces each, shinsoy and hum-hums. For Mr. Green at the Elephant, 50-gallon kettles, 20 warming pans, 15 bake kettles, 10 pair smoking tongs. For Mr. Perigo, 1 set of awls. For Mr. Nightingale, 50 reams prime foolscap. Said the Sabaoth thrice last night, but none appeared. I must hear more from Mr. H. in Transylvania, though it is hard reaching him and exceeding strange he cannot give me the use of what he hath so well used these 100 years. Simon hath not writ these 5 weeks, but I expect soon hearing from him."
When upon reaching this point Dr. Willett turned the leaf, he was quickly checked by Ward, who almost snatched the book from his grasp. All that the doctor had a chance to see on the newly opened page was a brief pair of sentences, but these, strangely enough, lingered tenaciously in his memory. They ran,
"He vows from Libidonatus being spoke 5 rudmuses and 4 hallows eves. I am hopeful the thing is breeding outside these spheres. It will draw one who is to come, if I can make sure he shall be. And he shall think on past things and look back through all the years, against the which I must have ready the salt or that to make him with."
Willett saw no more, but somehow this small glimpse gave a new and vague terror to the painted features of Joseph Kerwin, which stared blandly down from the overmantel. Even after that he entertained the odd fancy, which his medical skill of course assured him was only a fancy, that the eyes of the portrait had a sort of wish, if not an actual tendency, to follow young Charles Ward as he moved about the room. He stopped before leaving to study the picture closely, marveling at its resemblance to Charles and memorizing every minute detail of the cryptical, colorless face, even down to a slight scar or pit in the smooth brow above the right eye. Cosmo Alexander, he decided, was a painter worthy of the Scotland that produced Raeburn, and a teacher worthy of his illustrious pupil, Gilbert Stuart. Assured by the doctor that Charles's mental health was in no danger, but that on the other hand he was engaged in researches which might prove of real importance, the Wards were more lenient than they might otherwise have been when during the following June the youth made positive his refusal to attend college. He had, he declared, studies of much more vital importance to pursue, and intimated a wish to go abroad the following year in order to avail himself of certain sources of data not existing in America. The senior Ward, while denying this latter wish as absurd for a boy of only 18, acquiesced regarding the university, so that after a none-too-brilliant graduation from the Moses Brown School, there ensued for Charles a 3-year period of intensive occult study and graveyard searching. He became recognized as an eccentric, and dropped even more completely from the sight of his family's friends than he had been before, keeping close to his work and only occasionally making trips to other cities to consult obscure records. Once he went south to talk with a strange old mulatto who dwelt in a swamp and about whom a newspaper had printed a curious article. Again he sought a small village in the Adirondacks whence reports of certain odd ceremonial practices had come. But still his parents forbade him the trip to the old world which he desired. Coming of age in April, 1923, and having previously inherited a small competence from his maternal grandfather, Ward determined at last to take the European trip hitherto denied him. Of his proposed itinerary he would say nothing save that the needs of his studies would carry him to many places, but he promised to write his parents fully and faithfully. When they saw he could not be dissuaded, they ceased all opposition and helped as best they could, so that in June the young man sailed for Liverpool with the farewell blessings of his father and mother, who accompanied him to Boston and waved him out of sight from the White Star Pier in Charlestown. Letters soon told of his safe arrival, and of his securing good quarters in Great Russell Street, London, where he proposed to stay, shunning all family friends, till he had exhausted the resources of the British Museum in a certain direction. Of his daily life he wrote but little, for there was little to write. Study and experiment consumed all his time, and he mentioned a laboratory which he had established in one of his rooms. That he said nothing of antiquarian rambles in the glamorous old city with its luring skyline of ancient domes and steeples and its tangles of roads and alleys whose mystic convolutions and sudden vistas alternately beckon and surprise was taken by his parents as a good index of the degree to which his new interest had engrossed his mind. In June, 1924, a brief note told of his departure for Paris, to which he had before made 1 or 2 flying trips for material in the Bibliothèque Nationale. For 3 months thereafter he sent only postal cards, giving an address in the Rue Saint-Jacques and referring to a special search among rare manuscripts in the library of an unnamed private collector. He avoided acquaintances, and no tourist brought back reports of having seen him. Then came a silence, and in October the Wards received a picture card from Prague, Czechoslovakia, stating that Charles was in that ancient town for the purpose of conferring with a certain very aged man supposed to be the last living possessor of some very curious medieval information. He gave an address in the Neustadt and announced no move till the following January, when he dropped several cards from Vienna telling of his passage through that city on the way toward a more easterly region whither one of his correspondents and fellow delvers into the occult had invited him. The next card was from Klausenberg in Transylvania and told of Ward's progress toward his destination. He was going to visit a Baron Ferenczi, whose estate lay in the mountains east of Rakus, and was to be addressed at Rakus in the care of that nobleman. Another card from Rakus a week later, saying that his host carriage had met him and that he was leaving the village for the mountains, was his last message for a considerable time. Indeed, he did not reply to his parents' frequent letters until May, when he wrote to discourage the plan of his mother for a meeting in London, Paris, or Rome during the summer, when the elder Wards were planning to travel in Europe. His researches, he said, were such that he could not leave his present quarters, while the situation of Baron Ferenczi's castle did not favor visits. It was on a crag in the dark wooded mountains, and the region was so shunned by the country folk that normal people could not help feeling ill at ease. Moreover, the Baron was not a person likely to appeal to correct and conservative New England gentlefolk. His aspect and manners had idiosyncrasies, and his age was so great as to be disquieting. It would be better, Charles said, if his parents would wait for his return to Providence, which could scarcely be far distant. That return did not, however, take place until May 1926, when after a few heralding cards, the young wanderer quietly slipped into New York on the Homeric and traversed the long miles to Providence by motor coach, eagerly drinking in the green rolling hills, the fragrant, blossoming orchards, and the white-steepled towns of Vernal, Connecticut, his first taste of ancient New England in nearly 4 years. When the coach crossed the Pawcatuck and entered Rhode Island amidst the fairy goldenness of a late spring afternoon, his heart beat with quickened force, and the entry to Providence along Reservoir and Elmwood Avenues was a breathless and wonderful thing despite the depths of forbidden lore to which he had delved. At the high square where Broad, Wabasset, and Empire Streets join, he saw before and below him in the fire of sunset the pleasant, remembered houses and domes and steeples of the old town, and his head swam curiously as the vehicle rolled down the terminal behind the Biltmore, bringing into view the great dome and soft, roof-pierced greenery of the ancient hill across the river, and the tall colonial spire of the First Baptist Church limed pink in the magic evening light against the fresh springtime verdure of its precipitous background. Old Providence! It was this place and the mysterious forces of its long, continuous history which had brought him into being, and which had drawn him back toward marvels and secrets whose boundaries no prophet might fix. Here lay the arcana, wondrous or dreadful as the case might be, for which all his years of travel and application had been preparing him. A taxicab whirled him through Post Office Square with its glimpse of the river, the old market house, and the head of the bay, and up the steep, curved slope of Waterman Street to Prospect, where the vast gleaming dome and sunset-flushed Ionic columns of the Christian Science Church beckoned northward. Then 8 squares past the fine old estates his childish eyes had known, and the quaint brick sidewalks so often trodden by his youthful feet. And at last the little white overtaken farmhouse on the right, on the left the classic Adam porch and stately bayed facade of the great brick house where he was born. It was twilight, and Charles Dexter Ward had come home.